Oyez, oyez, oyez. Silence is commanded on pain of imprisonment while the honorable justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia are sitting. All persons having business with this court will draw near and give their attention. Any having pleas to enter or suits to prosecute, let them come forward and they shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to this session of the Supreme Court of Virginia. I'm Chief Justice S. Bernard Goodwin. All the justices of the court are present, along with Senior Justice Lawrence Koontz and Senior Justice Leroy Millette, who are sitting because of two current vacancies on the court. Senior Justice Koontz will be participating virtually from his office in Salem. For the last case on today's docket, Senior Justice Russell will be sitting instead of Senior Justice Millette. The audio of this session is being live streamed on a link which can be accessed at the Virginia Supreme Court website. Welcome, everyone. Do we have Justice Koontz? Okay, please call the first case.
Commonwealth versus Kilpatrick. Craig W. Stallard, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellants Counsel. Timothy R. Clinton, Greg M. Lipper, Appellees Counsel.
May it please the court, this is Timothy Clinton on behalf of Appellee. There in the court, a member of the District of Columbia Bar, is my colleague Gregory M. Lipper, who will be arguing on behalf of the appellee.
Thank you very much. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. Mr. Kilpatrick was convicted of multiple counts of solicitation of a minor. The issue on appeal is whether the trial court erred by abusing its discretion and excluding expert testimony that Mr. Kilpatrick was tested and found not to be a pedophile. The court did not abuse its discretion in excluding the expert testimony. While this type of testimony has been identified by different things in the course of this litigation, specifically Mr. Kilpatrick deems it to be motive evidence, I think ultimately what the reality of this testimony would be is that the expert would have told the jury that this is not the type of person who commits this kind of offense. That type of testimony would clearly invade the province of the jury, because it is the jury itself who's supposed to decide, based on the facts before it, whether or not the defendant committed the offense at issue. Essentially, given the fact the proffer was they would just tell the jury that he was not a pedophile, without any type of proffer of what that definition means or what it means to be or not be a pedophile. The layperson, when they hear the word pedophile, immediately goes to the idea of child molester. So essentially, what he wanted to do was to tell the jury their client was not a child molester. Again, invading the province of the jury, given the overwhelming evidence presented that established he did in fact engage in graphic sexual conversation with someone he had reason to believe was a 13-year-old, that somehow, based on this expert testimony, that somehow would undo the facts of this case and that he should have been acquitted.
How is this different from instances where the Commonwealth is permitted to offer evidence, for example, in a number of ways, but for example, in drug cases where the officer will testify, it's inconsistent with personal use. Help us with drawing those distinctions.
Okay, yeah, and I think that's a fair question, because that's the point the Court of Appeals pointed to, is like the Commonwealth does this on a routine basis. But I think the major difference between the type of case where the Commonwealth is using expert testimony in this case is that the expert testimony in those cases is there are facts being presented to the jury. Especially in a drug case, it's like there's a pound of cocaine, there's two cell phones, there's digital scales, there's multiple zip baggies on the side. And because we do this on a regular basis, we know what that means. The lay jury does not. So in those cases, the expert testimony is there merely to let the fact finder know, whether it's a jury or trial judge, what the significance of those facts are. Now, also in those cases, the defense is permitted to bring in their own expert to say, well, these facts can also mean something else. So it's not just that the Commonwealth is doing this out of a whole cloth and with no other facts being presented. It's these facts are before the jury. The jury knows about the cocaine, knows all the cell phones and all the other facts. The purpose of the opinion testimony there is merely to give the fact finder some understanding of what that means.
So, counsel, to interrupt you a second, you would think it would be okay then for a expert witness to testify on behalf of the defense that quantity of cocaine was consistent with personal use?
He could do that, and it would be subject to cross-examination, just like the expert from the Commonwealth.
So draw the distinction between that testimony and this testimony today.
Well, The difference here is the jury would still, in the drug type case, the jury still has all those facts. They have the cocaine, they have the thing, and they can make a decision about whether or not the expert's testimony is credible based on the totality of the evidence. Here we have an expert testimony saying he is not a pedophile. There is nothing else in the record to help support that expert's testimony. The only thing the jury has in this case is the fact that his months-long communication with someone he had reason to believe was 13 years old. And those two things juxtaposed to each other is a different scenario than what would happen in like your typical drug case where we're dealing with expressing an opinion on facts that have been presented to the jury as opposed to an opinion based on something that happened outside the presence of the jury.
Let me ask you this. Being a pedophile is not an element of the offense, is it?
It's not specifically an element, but it goes to the ultimate issue, which is whether or not he committed the offense.
Well, how can something that's not an element go to the ultimate issue then?
Goes to the jury has to make a decision whether or not this individual committed the offense. And if you put on testimony that it'd be the same. Let me flip the script, if I may, Your Honor, see if this helps to address the question. The Commonwealth could not put on testimony that this person meets the profile of a drug dealer. And just say, well, drug dealers are generally between 20 and 25 years old. They generally don't have any other job. They generally live in this particular environment. And then, of course, and then tries to trust me.
Why couldn't the Commonwealth do that? It's not because it's the ultimate issue. They couldn't do it for a lot of reasons, I believe.
I think it's ultimate issue, and it goes to ultimately propensity, which is, again, a reason we don't put on that testimony, because that's the decision of the jury to decide whether or not he committed the offense. And this, I think, goes more towards propensity evidence than it does to just expressing an opinion.
Under 2704B, could the Commonwealth put on evidence that he is a pedophile? 2704B seems to allow evidence of the defendant's mental disorder and the hypothetical effect of that. So could the Commonwealth put on evidence that he is a pedophile under that?
I would be reluctant to say yes, just because I think the problem, one of the problems I think the Commonwealth has is the word pedophile is such a loaded word, especially in today's environment, that, and I'm not going to say it would overbear.
Is that a mental disorder?
I believe it is. Under the DSM, it is considered a mental disorder.
And so the rule seems to indicate that an expert may testify as to a defendant's mental disorder.
Even assuming that's the case, it doesn't necessarily implicate that the adverse would also be true.
Why not? Well, I mean, if the defendant's theory is, I have a mental disorder, I can have a shrink come and testify to it, and it eliminates the inference of motive, why wouldn't the Commonwealth be able to put on exactly the inverse evidence in any case it wants to?
Well, unfortunately, there's a practical consideration, but I think the legal issue is, the rule specifically permits evidence of a mental disorder. It doesn't say mental disorder or lack of mental disorder. So think under the plain language of the thing of the rule, it doesn't encompass that type thing. You can't have an expert come and say he's a perfectly normal person, therefore he didn't likely commit the offense. That's not really the intention, I think, of what the rule is. The rule is, if you have some condition which makes it either more likely that you might have a lack of understanding or something like that, which is relevant to the issues before the court, that might be something where it's relevant and admissible. But just to come in and say, like, well, he doesn't have any of those conditions, seems to be the inverse of what the rule was intended to do.
Well, propensity can't work just one way.
No, it shouldn't work at all. I think the rules of Virginia are clear that we can't put on propensity evidence. And that's essentially what he's doing.
He's putting on anti-propensity evidence.
He's unlikely to have done it because he is not a pedophile. But even on brief, they acknowledge being a pedophile doesn't preclude you from being able to violate. So then, which also then leads into a relevance issue. If it doesn't preclude it, is it really a defense? So there are multiple things, I think, moving simultaneously, which makes this somewhat confusing. But
how does the new statute affect this, 19.2, 271.6?
I think it's the same issue. It talks about mental conditions that could affect the defendant. Here, we're not talking about anything that is a mental condition that affects his ability. It's more the inverse issue. So I think between the rule and the statute, it's the same type of analysis and issue. because it, and as he points out on brief, he says the Commonwealth will really routinely point out whether or not like child pornography is found on the victim, on the defendant's computer and stuff like that. And again, that's a factual issue. They're not saying because there was child porn found, he's a pedophile. And in this case, the trial court specifically told the defendant, if you want to put on factual evidence, you can do that. It's just, I'm not going to let you put on an expert opinion to opine on this issue. So the defendant was free and was told he can put on whatever factual evidence he thinks is relevant. The only concern here was putting on expert opinion testimony, but putting that stamp of scientific authority on that testimony.
Do we get to the question in this case, given the dissent at the Court of Appeals?
Well, moving to the harmless error, I think the dissent was well-reasoned in the sense that, given the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's clear understanding that she was 13, the communications throughout the entire interaction between the two, he's referring to as a 13-year-old, talking about, can't wait till you're 16, even though ultimately when stopped by the police, he says he's there to meet a 14-year-old. It's not until he's actually sitting down talking to the police does he start talking about, well, I thought she was older. There's absolutely no evidence that he had any indication she was any age other than 13 until we get the end of it when dealing with the police. Excuse me. So given the overwhelming evidence, the court likely need not reach the issue of whether this was anything other than harmless error. But
I'm interested in your phraseology, likely not need to.
Well, the concern I have is, and I don't like the slippery slope arguments the sky is falling. The problem I have, if this court thinks it's okay sometimes to present evidence of profile, like he meets or does not meet the profile of a drug dealer, he does or does not meet the profile of a child molester, that could likely lead to problems down the road, most likely from the defense bar. But it seems to me that's a problematic area to get into, because fact, the criminal cases should be decided on the facts, not whether or not someone meets the profile of someone who commits this type of offense, which is essentially what is trying to be happen here. That he doesn't meet the profile of a child molester, therefore the court should acquit him.
If that's relevant and that's admissible, your thesis would be the same would be true for the prosecution. They can bring in a DSM expert that says he says he didn't think this young person was a young person, but actually he has a psychological profile to desire, which is his motive, which illustrates his intent. So if we allow it in for one side, how can we not say it's inadmissible for the other?
Well, and I agree. I think the thing is whether or not someone meets the profile of a particular type of offender of an offense should be excluded for everybody. But other than that, I think if you get down to specific instances, like I think they cited the issue of like the expert dealing with drug culture, gang culture. That doesn't really go to the concerns that the Commonwealth has in this instance. That's dealing more generally with the background and the scenario of what's going on with respect to the crime, not whether or not this specific defendant had a disease or defect or lack thereof, which made it likely or unlikely for him to commit the offense. I think the issue should be decided on the facts as they're presented. And that's true, I think, for both sides. And I understand there is some concern about this, but I think, generally speaking, it makes more sense to decide this on the facts of the case and not whether or not someone meets the profile based on expert opinion. I'll be happy to address any questions. Otherwise, I'd reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Lipper, I understand that you're appearing pro hoc vici, and Mr. Clinton appeared earlier to introduce you. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Greg Lipper on behalf of Mr. Kilpatrick. I want to start by noting what the expert was proffered would have said and what he would not have said, because Mr. Stallard used the word essentially, he would have said that Mr. Kilpatrick did not fit the profile of someone who would commit this crime. That essentially, the stuff after essentially, the inferences after essentially were not what the expert was going to testify about. He was going to testify only as a general matter as to whether Mr. Kilpatrick was sexually interested in minors. He was going to say nothing about a profile of someone who is a child molester, who is a child solicitor, what his intent was in this case. He was not going to address the specific facts of this case at all. And so what Mr. Stallard is saying is he doesn't like the inferences that the jury might draw from that testimony. Jury might draw other inferences because, as we discuss in our brief, and as you know, children's rights organizations even acknowledge, that not all pedophiles commit sex crimes, and not all people who commit child sex crimes are pedophiles. So this evidence is no different, and it is in fact further away from the ultimate issue line than much of the evidence.
Counsel, as I understand your argument in a nutshell, you want the expert to say that there's no DSM diagnosis for pedophilia, therefore he didn't have the motive to commit the crime. Is that a fair
summary? The first part is fair. The second part is the reason it's relevant, but the expert would not have been testifying about.
I get that, but that was the reason you put him on. You want him to say, the expert's going to say, there's no DSM diagnosis of pedophilia, therefore lawyers take over argument. He didn't have a motive to commit this crime. If that's true, and if that's admissible, why couldn't in every single one of these cases, the Commonwealth, the prosecution, put on its evidence, in its case in chief, saying, you know what, we have substantial evidence been reviewed by a psychiatrist, we're going to put him on the stand, and the psychiatrist is going to opine that this man, in fact, has a diagnosable DSM coding of pedophilia, therefore permitting the jury to draw the inference that that was his motive for committing this child abuse case. So what I'm getting at is, if you win this case under the logic that you're presenting, I don't know why it wouldn't be exactly true for the Commonwealth to be able to prove the inverse. It can't be admissible for you and not admissible for the other side.
So a couple of points on that. I think the first thing is that this, I think, type of testimony is going to be, as a practical matter, useful in a very small minority of cases, because this case, and I think this goes to harmlessness as well.
Can the prosecution use it in the small minority of cases? Suppose the prosecution has an expert says your client has a diagnosable pedophilia condition and presents an expert that says that, and you don't have any experts saying otherwise because the facts are what the facts are. Can they do that under your theory of law?
I would think, because the other practical limitation I see, and it may, you know, so for instance, in the context of insanity, the insanity defense, if the defendant puts insanity at issue, at that point,
Motive is always at issue, because motive illustrates intent. So the prosecution can prove you have a motive, and the defense can prove, but we didn't have a motive. So my question is, could the prosecution put on exactly the inverse expert opinion to demonstrate an inference of motive to prove intent for a specific intent crime?
I think that in theory, yes. I think, again, whether the prosecution is permitted to forensically examine the defendant.
Different absent, question.
Right. But I think in theory, and that's why, as this court held last year, the Commonwealth can and regularly does put on evidence, for instance, if the defendant had a collection of child pornography. And in fact, in the case that was decided last year, even child pornography that the defendant possessed after the alleged offense in this case was admitted, because the government wanted to use it to show motive. And so the Commonwealth, if there is evidence that the defendant is a pedophile or is sexually attracted to minors, Commonwealth typically will have access to that evidence. The defendant can't, I mean, the inverse on the pornography example, for instance, the defendant can't really put on evidence as like, well, I have a collection of adult pornography, therefore I'm not. So there's already some asymmetries inherent.
So why can't the prosecution hire an expert that says, I've reviewed the child pornography that was found on this man's computer. The evidence that presented to me is that he reviewed it on these number of occasions. I can tell you this clearly meets the criteria for DSM umpty-ump that he is a pedophile. Could they do that?
I don't see why not, and I'm actually not sure in that instance how helpful would it be for them, because I think the implications of child pornography are clear, and it would still leave the defense free to argue that not, you know, being a pedophile is not the same thing as committing the offense, just as the prosecution in this case was free to argue that not being a pedophile doesn't mean that he didn't commit the offense. The other thing is, I just want to point out, and as the Court of Appeals found, this also, evidence is also relevant to the issue of entrapment. And because predisposition is, or lack of predisposition, is a requirement for entrapment. And this evidence, again, while the expert was not going to talk about predisposition, was not going to address the ultimate issue, again, was addressing whether or not the defendant had a sexual interest in minors was clearly relevant to the predisposition question, which in a case like this, in which entrapment is offered as a defense, would have been relevant. The reason I also say a small minority of cases,
the Court of Appeals decision was not on predisposition, it was on motive.
They also addressed the predisposition towards the end of their opinion. And in fact, in footnote 13, they in fact drew the distinction. They said on remand, the expert could testify about sexual interest in minors or lack thereof, because that's relevant to predisposition. The expert can't go the extra step and offer an opinion about predisposition itself.
Right, but I mean, the point is the novelty of the Court of Appeals opinion is the holding was it could be used for the prima facie case of intent, not the affirmative defense of predisposition and entrapment.
I also want to point out, I think, novelty, I think it was the first published opinion of its kind in the Commonwealth, but and we cite in our brief, there's two federal appellate courts, the D.C. Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, who have applied the similar line that we're proposing and that the Court of Appeals found. And I've seen no indication of any problems or chaos in federal child pornography or child sex prosecutions where this is an issue. So we now have at least several years of experience in the District of Columbia and in the three states that are part of the Seventh Circuit. I can certainly tell you as a practitioner in the District of Columbia that child sex prosecutions are, continuing at a healthy pace in federal courts even.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? The argument that Mr. Stoller made about the dangers of profiling both sides, was that argument ever made to the trial court, or was the entire argument the ultimate issue?
The entire argument was the ultimate issue, and the other point I'd wanted to add is Mr. Stoller suggested a bit in his reply brief and a bit today that that there would have been confusion about what is the definition of a pedophile or the facts on which Dr. Fisher reached his opinion. All of those types of concerns are properly addressed in a challenge under the normal process of challenging the admissibility of an expert, whether the qualifications of the expert, whether the methodology is accepted. None of those challenges were made in this case. The expert, Dr. Fisher, was applying several different well-accepted, decades-old methods for evaluating. So he was doing textbook science. And if there is a case in which the expert is not, and the expert is speculating or using definitions that are irrelevant to the case or that are not accepted or using methodologies that aren't accepted, the Commonwealth is free to, as with any experts, challenge the admissibility under the standard, the standard bases for challenging admissibility. I want to turn to the issue of harmless error. And the first point I'd like to make is I think the Commonwealth's argument that the inferences from this expert testimony are so overpowering as to almost guarantee an acquittal, well, I think certainly overstated, I think does belie the other argument that excluding this evidence would have had no, or admitting this testimony would have had no effect on the verdict. Both of those things can't be true. This was powerful motive evidence. It was motive evidence. It was not ultimate issue, but it was important evidence. And the reason I answered earlier why this would come up in the expert issue would come up in a small minority of cases is that it's a rare case in which there is actually significant evidence and was significant reason for the defendant to believe that he was talking to an adult who was pretending to be a minor. A couple of things. The person didn't state his or her age for a month. He talked about activities like driving, like having a job, like shooting a rifle. The photo that was sent, the photo that the officer sent of a, which obviously was not him, but was the persona that he was playing, was a photo of an adult in her mid-20s.
Wasn't that quintessential a fact-finding issue for the jury?
It is a fact finding.
The jury saw the picture and concluded that he was guilty.
Well, absolutely, it's a fact finding issue, but the I think the question is, would the addition of evidence showing that Mr. Kilpatrick did not have a motive, could that have affected the jury's verdict? We're here, of course, because the jury found him guilty, but the evidence was not so one-sided to suggest that were there additional evidence that Mr. Kilpatrick could have offered, they would have reached the same results.
What do we make of his statement to the police officers that he was there bringing cookies to a 14-year-old?
Well, I think, you know, he was, I think, also said to the police officers that there's no way she's that young. I've never seen someone that young communicate like she did. Was she even a real person? So, you know, I think he made a number of statements. I think he made a number of statements even at the time suggesting disbelief that the person was an actual minor or was a minor at all. He also, and just to take a step back, he spoke to the police, he waived his Miranda rights, he gave, you know, took a polygraph, he let the police inspect his phone and gave them his password. You know, a number of things that, you know, I think, you know, to be candid, give me as a criminal defense attorney a heart attack. But I mean, this was not, I think, consistent with someone who was a Machiavellian trying to talk his way out of something. And yet, even then, he was insistent that this person was communicating like an adult, and, you know, which the person was an adult in communicating that way. Again, it is certainly possible for the jury to have reached.
But is that really the harmless error standard in a non-constitutional context? It's certainly possible.
Well, no, but I think not in so many words, but it is the Commonwealth's burden to show that it is clear that the information would not have affected the verdict. And given the unusual and significant evidence from which Mr. Kilpatrick could have and testified that he did conclude he was dealing with an adult pretending to be a minor, that in this case, the Commonwealth has not met its burden. In addition to all of the other things we discussed, I mean, you know, some of the other things talking about that the person stated that she was a student in Lynchburg, which is, you know, home to several colleges and universities. Mr. Kilpatrick asked, what are you studying? Which is reflective of like a kind of a what's your major, which is a question you wouldn't ask to someone you thought was in high school, that she was home for the summer. You know, just a number of things that are, and also I think, and this is hard to you know, put into concise words, but the overall manner of communication, right? That the fact that it was an adult, it does not seem like the officer was making a significant effort to pretend to communicate in the fashion that a minor would communicate. That's what Mr. Kilpatrick told the police immediately after he was arrested. I mean, even the statement he made in the context of the role playing on Craigslist that, you know, I like talking to you is sort of, I think, a nod to the communication style, which, you know, suggests someone who is older. And again, I'm not saying the jury had to accept all this, but certainly I don't see how the Commonwealth can say, given the high standard, the high burden the Commonwealth bears to show that the error was harmless, given all of the evidence that Mr. Kilpatrick thought he was dealing with an adult.
May I ask you this? Does 19.2.271.6, the July 1 enactment date of last year, does that apply to this case? And would it apply, or would it apply if the case were remanded for any reason?
I don't know. Hesitant to answer too quickly, I would say my inclination is that it probably did not apply at the time, or, you know,
your trial was
at the time,
before
but would
July
have applied
1.
Going forward, although I'm...
Your trial was prior to July 1, 2021, is that correct?
That's correct.
So this is the later statute, and I noticed the briefs didn't address it, but the General Assembly has spoken on a very similar issue, if not arguably exactly the same issue, of the role of DSM diagnoses with respect to criminal defendants in criminal cases. And neither side addresses it, and it certainly would inform us to know what the General Assembly thinks about the subject.
I see my time has expired. May I answer?
Yes, you may.
I would say this, to the extent it, neither side has raised it at this point. I think if, for instance, if the court wishes supplemental briefing, we'd be happy to address it. I think given that, you know, we in the Commonwealth haven't argued that the trial took place before this statute, you know, I think it's not directly relevant, but to the extent it informs what would happen, you know, on remand or otherwise, we'd be happy to address it if the court has, you know, would like us to file supplemental briefs or otherwise on it.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 38 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be quick. First of all, to address Justice Millett's question from earlier, since I'm asking this court to affirm the trial court, I'm not sure 525 would preclude the court from reaching the issue, even though it wasn't presented to the trial court. Mr. Kilpatrick is saying he cooperated with the police, and that should be viewed in his favor. I'd also point out to the court that he told Jenny to delete the phone, delete all the messages, and he also used a fake name during this interaction, which I think shows potential guiltiness of conscience. The photograph that was given out was in fact of an older person, but that's exactly the same facts that happened in the Stoltz case. In this case, court decided where the photograph was sent of an animal control officer, clearly someone over the age, and the court still found that was sufficient to reach the issue that he had reason to believe.
Not in the appendix, but it's in the record.
Yeah. Given the totality of circumstances, I don't think the photograph alone should be an issue, because clearly a 13-year-old who would engage in this conduct in the first place may be unlikely to send a photograph of herself, and the fact they may send one of either an older sibling or something they find on the internet should not preclude a conviction in a case like this just because the photograph may not be of a 13-year-old. Can't even read my own handwriting now, sorry. And to follow up on that, there's nothing inconsistent with what the officer did in this case to what a 13-year-old could have done in this case. The fact they said the word, we drove by the college, when she meant we rode by the college. I've used that terminology. I think it's a fairly common use of the word drive. You're not literally driving, but you're in a car that rides by. You say, we drove by. That's not necessarily uncommon or inconsistent with what a 13-year-old would do. So I think he had a reason to believe she was 13. I think the evidence at issue here is at best troubling. I think opening the Pandora's box, if you will, to allowing profile type evidence could lead to problems, but I understand the court's concerns that it cuts both ways, and I get that. But I would ask this court to affirm the trial court, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have in my last 20 plus seconds if the court has any additional questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please call the next case.